You're listening to the Ayn Rand Institute Live podcast series. What Tribalism Looks Like Around the World by Alain Journo.
So I want to talk about tribalism around the world. And I want to tell you why I think it's important to do this kind of perspective on the issue. So what we've been trying to do at the conference is give you a perspective on tribalism in today's culture and its alternative, individualism, and explore it. And you've seen manifestations of it in law, you've seen it in politics, you've seen it in your personal life, in family relationships. We've seen a whole range of examples of it sort of domestically in sort of our experience, and I think many of us here are either from North America or Western Europe or other parts of the world where you have some experience of this. But I think it's helpful to broaden our perspective. So I'm going to just summarize what I take tribalism to be. This should be familiar from some of the previous presentations. And it's basically an idea that you belong to some group primarily through being born into it, not because you chose it, not because it's about ideas you believe in. And it's often, it's an accident of birth. And it's non-intellectual. It's not about principles or ideas that matter to you. And the other thing that goes along with this, as you've seen, is you owe loyalty to whatever group that is. So that's sort of just a quick summary of what we've been talking about in terms of tribalism. I'm just going to take that for granted from previous presentations. And on the other hand, individualism is that you are responsible for your own life. You take that responsibility up and you decide your own path. And the primary thing you have to do is to think for yourself and make decisions about what matters in your life, what values you're going to pursue, what ideals you're going to live up to. So those are very different perspectives on life. I think it takes work to think about these things and understand them and apply them and see them in the world. And part of our goal has been to help you get a better handle on both of those ideas and figure out what you want in your life. Do you think, are there aspects of your life where there's tribalism? Are there aspects where you recognize the individualism and you want more of it? I hope you will see that. So even seeing examples of tribalism around the culture, I think there's still a way in which it's hard to take the concept and really see its full scope. So I think you can see that in the way that people sometimes come to false assumptions or mistaken views of tribalism. And one of these is that if you grew up in North America or parts of Europe, you have, I'm pretty sure, and I think everyone in this room has, a significant amount of respect for the individual. We recognize that you judge individuals by their own choices and actions, the content of their character. That's a common view, and we have it reflected in institutions of government. We see it in all over the place. Now, what happens, and this is the false assumption I think that many of us make, is we tend to take that as our perspective on that as the norm, and we tend to project it outside and think, well, everyone, like us, everywhere else, has some respect for the individual. That's sort of the normal. That has to be true everywhere, right? I think that's a mistake. And part of what I'll do in my presentation is correct that assumption. The other thing that goes wrong, I think, in people's attempt to understand these issues, tribalism and individualism, is to have too narrow a view of tribalism. Now, we've given you examples from a whole range of areas in human life and culture, but I think we get that there are problems in our society, and they're real problems, and I'm not minimizing them. But part of what happens is people assume that, you know, we have real problems here, and there's no appreciation, and partly because people don't understand, but there's sort of a mis-evaluation of tribalism outside of our experience. It's as if we have problems, but it can't be that significant elsewhere in the world. And again, I think that is false. I think if you broaden your conception of tribalism and take examples and get data from other parts of the world and other cultures, you realize that that's not at all the right way to think about it. So my goal is to give you that wider perspective by looking at examples of tribalism from other cultures and other parts of the world. And the takeaway that I hope you'll leave this room with is that when you take that wider perspective on the phenomenon of tribalism, you realize that you're better able to evaluate it and to appreciate the alternative. And I'm going to do this by giving you three stories from different parts of the world.
And what unites these stories, the theme that I want to present in today's talk, is that tribalism is in fact widespread, it is deep-rooted, and it is poisonous. Poisonous to human life. So I want to start with a story that takes place in the country of Rwanda. Now, by a show of hands, how many people have heard of the country of Rwanda? Yeah, that's what I thought. How many people know where it is? Good. If those of you don't know, you don't have to put your hands up. That's where it is. It's in the middle of Africa. Now, my bet, my bet is if you've heard of it, it's most likely because that it's a synonym for an event that happened there in 1994, a genocide, a mass killing. And I want to tell you a little bit about this incident because I think it is an example of tribalism in action. So first, what happened, and then the case for why this was a manifestation of tribalism and how it is that tribalism is such a destructive force. So the quick summary of what happened in Rwanda is that this was a culture, a society that was divided along very sharp tribal lines. The two main groups were the Hutu and the Tutsis. And the idea in this society was that although there was friction between them, they didn't always get along, they were fairly integrated. They went to the same schools, they worked in the same offices, they went to the same churches, and their neighbors were fairly integrated. And yet, in a matter of 100 days, roughly 100 days in 1994, neighbor went after neighbor. They picked up machetes and other weapons, and they literally killed each other in the street. Not thousands of people, not 20,000, not 50,000. 800,000 people died in this killing. 800,000 people. That was roughly 1 in 7 of the population was killed, was murdered in this tribal conflict. And another 2 million or so fled their home. So a massive, massive impact on that culture and that country. Now, you can't understand that. Now, that's a huge number of people. And you can't understand that without recognizing and getting an appreciation for the depth to which this was a tribal manifestation. And the way I want to illustrate that is to tell you a little about how... So in the killing, it was the Hutu ethnic group, as they saw themselves, were killing off the Tutsis. That's an important part of the story. So what I want to do is illustrate for you how they thought about this. Because I think the issue with tribalism, it's a mindset. It's a way of looking at the world. And that's part of why it's deep-seated, deep-rooted. So to do that, I want to tell you a little bit about how the Hutu community and its leaders were talking about their enemies, the other group, the Tutsis. And there's a mass amount of propaganda that you can find online and other sources where you see the ways in which the Hutu leadership were riling up their followers, their group members, and pushing them towards violence. And this was a matter of several years. It didn't happen overnight. There's a lot of preparation for it. So here are some examples of how the tribal mindset was activated, was sort of really supercharged, and then armed and unleashed. So here's an example of how the Hutu leadership portrayed society and the way to understand it. So there was a document that came out roughly 1990, so several years before the mass killing, and it came to be known as the Hutu Ten Commandments. It was published in a newspaper, and it was widely read and circulated, and people shared it. This lists what it means to be a good Hutu, what it means to be loyal to your group. Here's a sampling of what it meant. So if you were a Hutu, your primary consideration should be to the solidarity with your brother Hutus. They come first, and you have to be loyal to them. And there's a number of things that are listed as crimes against your group. One of them was if you have dealings with the Tutsis, because they are our enemy. Group comes first. You have to be loyal to your group. Now, what does it mean to be a Hutu? Remember, it means that you were born to a family that are Hutu. It's passed on through inheritance, through the accident of birth. And one of the bizarre things in Rwanda is that people had to have their ethnic identity, their tribal identity, registered officially. Right? This is part of a government policy. And yet people shifted. Sometimes for advantages, they would tell people that they were Tutsi. Sometimes they would tell them they were Hutus, which should tell you that whatever people say about their tribal identity, it wasn't fixed. It's not like you could easily tell people apart. And moreover, people intermarried. So you could have mixed parentage, right, to the extent that you take these categories as seriously. Now, if your loyalty was to the group, what else does it mean to be a good Hutu? The other thing is to recognize that those people, the Tutsis, are evil. And they're evil in a particular way. It's not because this individual, that individual, you or you as a Tutsi have done something wrong. It's that you were born to that group. Nothing you did, but you just happened to be born by the accident of who your parents were to be a Tutsi. And there's a really chilling newspaper article that was written, and one of the lines in it is, cockroaches cannot give birth to butterflies. Just think about that. The first thing here is the equation of people with pests, with cockroaches. So the Tutsis are a kind of pest, they're vermin. They're cockroaches. And what does it mean that they can't give birth to butterflies? They can't change into something else. If they're evil, if their ancestors have done bad things to us, and this is a whole story about how the ancestors were evil, then their offspring are going to be evil. Cockroaches give birth to cockroaches forever in perpetuity. They cannot change. That is part of what it means to regard a group of people as members of a tribe. You evaluate them all by virtue of the accident of their birth. And they can't change it. It's a fact of nature, according to this view. Now, this dehumanizing of the Tutsis, this opposed group, meant that they would, part of it meant that they characterized them as subversive and hostile, and they're trying to get away with taking advantage of the Hutu. And so there's all kinds of stories that are told about how the Tutsis, the hated group, are like cockroaches, and they sneak in like snakes, and they exploit us. All of them, to a person, are evil. And that's the message that was drummed into people for years and years. And if what you hear constantly is that every member of that group is evil, and they're like cockroaches, and they are destroying your society, and then somebody tells you that, well, what do you do when you have a rat infestation or when cockroaches are taking over your kitchen? What do? You get rid of them. Extermination. And that is literally the word that was used. The goal that was set as part of this campaign was to exterminate the filth. This is another word they used for the Tutsis, to exterminate them. Now, part of what makes this chilling is that this is not the first time people have talked about other groups in terms of extermination. You think of the echoes here of World War II. Now, what made this possible was the idea that every single Tutsi is evil by birth and forever. It's unchangeable. There's no conception of the reality of an individual person, that their character and actions and moral worth are the result of their actions. That's unreal. There's only members of this sort of blob that we call the tribe, and their character is determined by the membership in that group. This is how you get to the point where 200,000 people, so what's important about the killing was not that the military led the way, which they did, it's that they recruited civilians to help them do it. And about 200,000 people were involved in the killing. So it literally was, when I say neighbor against neighbor, it really meant handing out machetes to the Hutus and telling them to go around and slaughter their neighbors because they are the wrong tribe. So I wanted to share this with you. It's a horrifying story, and I'm leaving out, trust me, I'm leaving out the really disgusting, horrible, brutal, and grisly details, which if you're interested, you can easily find. what I want to stress here is that the story of the Rwanda mass killing, this is what people call genocide, it's a paradigm case of a genocide. It is a tribal phenomenon. It is what happens when tribalism is riled up, it's agitated, it's activated as something important and central to people's lives. It's armed and then unleashed. That is what it looks like to take the tribal mentality fully and seriously. That is what it means. 800,000 people died because tribalism was put into practice fully. Okay, let's draw a line on Rwanda. You can ask me questions about that. I welcome it. Let's turn to a different example. So that was two groups of people in Africa. Let's turn to a different part of the world. I want to tell you a story about a woman or a young girl in Afghanistan. Some people are geographically challenged, so I'm helping you out. No need to identify yourselves. This is important because this story happens in Afghanistan, but it's a phenomenon that isn't restricted to Afghanistan. But I think it's a good illustration of this phenomenon. So the young woman's name is Amina. She grew up in Afghanistan, and when the story happens, she's 18 years old. All right, is anyone here 18? Everyone else has been 18. Now, she had trouble at home, and it became really serious to the point where she took the drastic step of running away from home. Now, I think that's an uncommon thing to do. I mean, I didn't know anyone who ran away from home when I was growing up. But in Afghanistan, it's a very dangerous thing to do. Let me tell you why she had trouble at home. In keeping with the tribal customs where she lived, her parents, her father in particular, had decided to marry her off to somebody, which is a very arranged marriage. But she didn't want to have anything to do with it. Her view was, I'm not interested in this person. I don't want to be married to him. And I'm not going to have you force me into this. And she wasn't able to get her way, so she ended up leaving home and running away. And it's important to understand that this is a common thing to marry girls off. They don't have a say in their own life. They're subordinated to the men in their families. And the family literally is a kind of micro or a mini tribe within a web of tribes. Now, fortunately, she managed to run away and find a shelter, and there are shelters in Afghanistan for women who have trouble dealing with their families, because this is a common phenomenon. So you might breathe a sigh of relief. She found a shelter, she was safe. The story doesn't end with her getting to the shelter, because it's her misfortune that her family found her, they tracked her down to the shelter, and they insisted that she comes home. Now, Amina was wise enough, even at the age of 18, she was wise enough to know that this is, you know, if you go back home to your parents, you're going to get punished, right? And the people who run the shelter were wise enough to know that most cases when girls go back home, they get punished. But after a while, there was a lot of back and forth, and her parents agreed. They signed a piece of paper saying, no harm will come to our daughter when she comes back home. And on top of it, they even testified in front of a video camera, so there'd be evidence of this agreement. So Amina decided, I don't want to make this into a bigger thing. They've agreed I'm not going to come to harm, and I believe them. And so she goes back home with them. She never makes it back home. She is shot to death on the way back home. Now, Amina is an example of what is called an honor killing. Her crime, her refusal to go along with an arranged marriage and defy her father and her family more broadly, was seen as an affront. It was it diminished the honor of the family. And it's important to see that the family here is a tribal phenomenon. It means that their honor, their prestige in the eyes of the other tribes around them, is bound up with the chastity or the sexual purity and the obedience of the women who are part of it. And if the woman, in Amina's case, all she did is say no. It's not the case that she married some other man even. She just said, I don't want to be married to this person. That was enough to destroy that family's honor. And I put that in scare quotes because I don't think that's a rational conception of honor or self-worth. Now, in this kind of perspective, the only way to resolve that insult to honor is how? The only way to resolve it is by shedding the blood of the tribal member who's non-conforming, who's defying the group. It literally means sacrificing that member for the sake of the tribe's honor. The tribe here is the family. It is restoring its prestige in the eyes of the other neighboring tribes, this web of families that are constantly looking at each other and judging them. Now, I want to say that honor killings are, I mean, they happen in Afghanistan, they happen in other countries too. It's not restricted to Afghanistan, and they're certainly not restricted to Muslim societies, though they're common in Muslim societies. The other thing to know is that although the idea of sexual purity of women it comes from religious ideas about what's important in life, I don't think it's primarily a religious phenomenon in this case. I think the idea of tribal group honor is central. I think that tribalism here is central to it. And the key thing is that women are seen as property, or they're objects. They're not individual human beings. Their minds, their choices, their values don't matter because in a deep way, on the tribalist way of thinking, they're not real. They're not individuals. They're just elements of a larger whole. And the larger whole comes first, the family first. And its honor, in this perverse sense of honor, has to dominate. And the only thing a woman can do is obey. And if anything short of obedience, whether that means falling in love with somebody else or refusing an arranged marriage or even looking too Western or not being submissive enough, not being religious enough, any of those non-conforming behaviors, that's enough to brand her as insulting the honor of the family. And again, the solution here is to eliminate that member of the tribe. They have to be pushed out, and that literally means killed, to absolve or to kind of restore the family's honor. It's an understatement to say that this kind of tribalism is poisonous. It literally, it kills. It's lethal. And I think the story of Amina and the wider phenomenon of honor killings in the name of the group's prestige and honor in the eyes of other groups, that is an example of how the tribal mindset leads to the destruction of human relationships, in addition to the destruction of human life. I want to tell you about a third story. And whereas the example of Afghanistan and Rwanda, I try to make those very stark and illustrate the role of tribalism here. This example is a mixed case. It's more complicated, and I'm just going to bring one element of it out to the surface. And I want to tell you, illustrate the role of tribalism in this conflict, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. It's happening in that little speck of land in the Middle East. And I want then to tell you why I think it's complicated and how to relate this to the importance of understanding tribalism, detecting it in society, and then figuring out how to separate it out for understanding. So many people think that the central issue in this conflict is tribal. It's two groups of people fighting over one piece of land. That is just the very common perspective on it. I don't think that's the right way to understand it. But tribalism is a part of this conflict, and I want to just indicate one illustration of that. So this is an incident that happened in 2014. There were three Israelis out hitchhiking. And in Israel, hitchhiking is a fairly common thing. People either take the bus or they hitchhike. It's not a very safe thing to do. I don't recommend it anywhere, but it happens and people do it. And there's this kind of culture of if you see someone on the road, you often stop and give them a ride. And often off-duty soldiers and teenagers just travel that way. So it's not an unusual thing for them to be doing. So this afternoon when they were out trying to get a ride, a car stopped, and a friendly voice said, you know, hop in. I'll give you a ride. Where are you going? Yeah, we got you. And the three of them came in to the car. And once they climbed in, they realized this isn't a standard hitchhiking opportunity. This was actually what was later discovered. This was a premeditated attempt to kidnap an Israeli teenager, and the group that was in the car was led by a group of Palestinians who are loyal to the Hamas, the Islamist group Hamas, and they had only planned to kidnap one teenager and use them as a pawn, but they got three, so they got more than they expected. These three teenage boys, or one of them was 19, I guess, was a little older than a boy, were never heard from again. They were found in a shallow grave about 18 days after they were abducted, shot to death. Now, what's significant about this case is why they were targeted, and then what happened after they were targeted. So why were they targeted? Well, in the eyes of the Palestinians who plotted this kidnapping and murder, these Israelis were members of a hated tribe, the Jews. And you have to understand that when they say Jews, they don't just mean people who go to synagogue and are faithful and loyal. It just means that group of people who are born to that community, and it doesn't really matter what ideas they hold, it's that they're the trespassers on Muslim land. That's sort of the way that the Hamas perspective looks at things, that they have no business being here. And any person within that tribe is fair game. So it's fairly random why they were picked up. It's not that they themselves, this is the important part. There are a lot of questions and controversies and disputes about grievances the Palestinians bring up. And those are hard issues, and I've written about them, and I'll tell you a bit more about that in my book. It's not the case that these three teenagers were involved in any alleged or real crimes against Palestinians. It just so happened that they were Israelis. That was their crime. They were in the wrong tribe. So that's the thinking that went into this heinous murder of three teenagers. Now, it's important to get that one of the things that happened in response to this was there was an Israeli, a religionist Israeli, who has a kind of tribal perspective of his own, picked up a Palestinian teenager, abducted him, and murdered him for precisely the same kind of reason, the same kind of tribal perspective. That teenager, the Palestinian teenager who was killed, was not, there was no direct connection between him and this particular crime that was being avenged. This was a reprisal. This was not vigilantism, like taking the law into your own house. There was no relationship. He was just a Palestinian. And from that tribal perspective, he was the wrong group. And there was a kind of enmity towards him. So both of these cases, and my point is not to equate, oh yeah, there's crazies on both sides. That's not the point. The way I know people sometimes think of it that way. What I'm trying to highlight here is that there is tribalism in all sorts of directions in this conflict. And some of the violence that you hear about is driven by this kind of tribalism on both sides. And it's really destructive. Now, I want to say a word about why I think although it's a salient feature of the conflict, it's not the central one or the fundamental one. Because I think what's really driving this and what I highlight in my book is that while that's a part of the issue, what's really driving it is ideas. There's a real conflict over how to organize societies and what it is that the Palestinians are seeking as a movement and what it is that Israel has accomplished. And I can tell you more about that. But the gist of my point is that what you need to do to understand this conflict and to understand this region and all the spillover effects is to get that while there's tribalism going on here, it is a component of a larger problem that has non-tribal factors. And the non-tribal ones are ideas about politics and ideology in Israel in terms of the society that it has created and built, and in among the Palestinians, the kind of society they want to build. And just to summarize it for you, my view is that the ideas here, the opposed ideas are, on one side there's a society in Israel that has created a largely free society where there's economic vibrancy, there's innovation and technology, and people are able to a large extent to live their lives. Opposed to that, over the many years this conflict has been going on, are groups and movements that are trying to implement various forms of collectivist, tribalist, and theocratic views of society. So to me, that's the fundamental factor in this conflict. But in order to get to that, you have to recognize the role of tribalism and pull those two apart and see how they interplay. All right, so that's why it's a complicated case, and I welcome questions on that. And I think many of you got a copy of the book. What I try to do in the book is to do exactly that, to separate out what are the ideas here, what do they tell us, and then to take an individualist perspective to unpacking it and understanding the issue. So I think it's a clarifying perspective on tribalism from that angle. So just taking a step back here, I told you about what I think are really horrific illustrations of tribalism in Rwanda, in Afghanistan, and in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. There are many more we could talk about. And what's significant is when you widen your field of view, when you take in more data, you understand, I think, you get a fuller picture of what tribalism really looks like. It looks like, in this country, we see it, if you guys remember the Charlottesville riots. We see white nationalists carrying torches like savages, right? That is a form of tribalism. But there's also other forms that are essentially driven by the same mindset, the same perspective on life, and the same devaluing of individuals, the same dehumanization and hatred for some other group, and the view of the other group as they're interchangeable. There's no individuality on the other side, and no attempt to think about and evaluate people as individuals. It's you were born to that group. We have a view of what you are, and you're evil, and we're going to treat you that way. So that perspective is broader than most people realize. It leads to significant bloodshed we've seen in Rwanda. It leads to the destruction of human relationships. I mean, the fate of women in Afghanistan and in other countries, Amina, unfortunately, the woman I told you about, her fate is not unique. There are many women like that. And that is a phenomenon driven by the idea that the group comes first. Its honor must come ahead of anything else. And any deviation from that, any nonconformity with the group, has to be cleansed with blood. That is poisonous. And this wider perspective on human life as dividing people by inherited accidental groups, it is really, really destructive. If it's poisonous, what is the alternative? What is an antidote? And I think one of the themes we've tried to encourage you to explore is that there is an alternative, and it's individualism. It's taking seriously that in reality, there are just individuals. We associate with one another and families and other kinds of groups, but those are consequences. Those come after the individual. What's central is who you are, what you make of your life, and how you evaluate people should be reflected in the same individualist perspective. You should understand people as the products of their own choices and not view them as members of some larger group that they have no choice in being part of. I think individualism is the right perspective here, and I hope you guys explore it. Part of why I think it's right is that it historically we can see that it has led to better human relationships. It has led to real human progress in terms of bringing people out into better societies and advancement. And it actually leads to freedom and peace. It's a foundational principle in that respect. So to get to that and to implement it and encourage people to embrace it, we need to understand it. And I hope the presentation today has given you not only a better, wider view of tribalism, but an appreciation for why it's important to have an alternative and what that alternative looks like. Thank you. Have some time for questions.
Yeah. Thank you. So you explain about, I'm referring to the macro level cases that you took, Rwanda and Israel, Palestine. So in the, like these tribal societies, yes, probably they killed each other, went to war with one another, but they had a certain equilibrium and they organized themselves. How do you view the role played by colonialism in making things better or worse? I just want to know your view. Thank you.
Sure. So what role has colonialism had in terms of tribal? Yeah. I think it's had in many cases that I've looked at and know in some detail, I think it's had a very bad effect. So the example of Rwanda is a case in point. So the idea of classifying the population of Rwanda according to tribal ethnic identity, there are three tribes in Rwanda, one of which I didn't mention. That was something that the Belgians, when they were in charge of the area, instituted. And it was a way of sort of a convenience for them, you know, a way of sorting society into the people we can deal with and then the people we can't deal with. And then what that did is it left behind, and it was a really bad thing to do. It was a common view among colonial powers that you deal with certain groups and you keep them as groups, as a sort of a racist, tribalist view. And I think it cemented tribal identity in a country and left it there so that, you know, whereas you might have hoped that people would move away from that, it kind of sunk it deeper into the society. And so I think it was a major contributing factor in people's, I think they would have been tribal even without that, but this kind of encouraged it as this is the way to organize people. So I think in those cases, that particular case I think is very bad. So I'll leave it there.
Thank you.
Yes.
So the three examples you looked at, all of those seem to have religion as a major factor in the dispute between the groups. And I'm sort of wondering how much of the tribalism in the world is religiously motivated. And it might be interesting to look at South Africa and the racial divisions there as an example where religion isn't the main factor, but something else is. So how much of this that you see in the world do you think is connected directly to religion versus sort of general tribalism?
So how much does religion play a role in tribal? I think the other example I was considering talking about today, but I left it out for time, is the sectarian conflicts within Islam. So the Sunni and Shiite groups, so those are the two major sects in Islam, they have been warring against each other in different places at different times brutally. And my perspective on that is the sectarian differences are really boiled down to a kind of religious tribalism. So religion is the vocabulary, the structure, the conceptualization that they bring to this, but it really boils down to, well, your parents were Sunni, so you're Sunni, and I was born to Shiite parents, and I'm Shiite, and we hate each other because you're heretics. When, you know, if you took religion as something more intellectual, so I'm an atheist, and I don't think religion has a place in a good life. But if you thought of religion as primarily a set of ideas, which is the way it's more commonly understood, you shouldn't think of children as being religious. It's something you choose to join. It's something you believe. And that's not at all the way it's held in Islam and in other religions, too. Typically, people inherit the religion of their parents. It's unusual for people to be of different religions. And that is, I think, a kind of tribalism. It's I belong to this group, now I'm going to accept their ideas. So I think religion is a factor in a lot of the tribal conflicts in the Middle East, and I think it even more broadly. So, and there's one other point I would add, which is, you know, I mentioned the Hamas operation to kidnap these Israeli teenagers. That is the fusion of religion and tribalism, because it's another example of it. Because part of the hatred that the Islamists have for infidels is very much like a tribal enmity. So it's all the Crusaders, that means Christians, and all the Jews, that means all the Jews, whether they believe or not, they're all bad, right? And that's a tribal way of thinking. It's not, well, there's better denominations of Christianity and some of them are more true to that's not at all part of the thinking of it. And when you read some of the documents of the Hamas movement, for example, it is full of this sort of standard anti-Semitic, anti-Jewish, not from the perspective, oh, they got the wrong God. It's, this is a tribe that we think of as vile. And so I think they really go together. Thanks for raising that question.
Thanks.
Okay, thanks, Ilan.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Ayn Rand Institute Live podcast. Subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you listen. You can also find us on YouTube. If you like this content, please share or leave us a review. For more information, go to AynRand.org.